I was just going to mention too, my son Andrew in England gave a lecture, Me, Myself, and I. And, it's developed into a book, and as a Hollywood movie guy wants to make it into a series of short episodes, so they're working on that. So.
And there three actors?
our prime minister's making a cameo.
Now, it's not essentially a biblical paper, but we should have a brief reading first. So, 2 Timothy chapter 4, just for an introduction. Good to be with you. Thankful to the Lord for safe journey, a slow journey, the first part at least, along the 403. 2 Timothy 4, just read the first 8 verses here. I charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing and his kingdom, preach the word. Be ready, in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, and exhort with complete patience and teaching. For the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own passions and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander off into myths. As for you, always be sober-minded. Endure suffering. Do the work of an evangelist. Fulfill your ministry. For I am already being poured out as a drink offering. The time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Amen. That is God's word. Mark has introduced myself. I'm Roger Fellows. Came to Canada 63 in pharmaceutical work. Into the ministry, a few months at TBS, and then ministering in Toronto for 6 years, 21 years in Bowmanville, back to England, long story there, pastorate in Yorkshire, then we came back, never expected to come back, but the Lord brought us back in 99, and serving as a coordinator of the Sovereign Grace Fellowship, and sort of entering capacity in a number of churches, we've sought to serve the Lord as best we could, as he is given enabling grace. And feeling a little bit lost at the moment because the two churches in which we were heavily involved, Pilgrim and Grimsby, are both called pastors. We're largely out of work, but I'm still preaching once or twice a month, so thankful to God for those opportunities. Well, I was asked to speak on the history of the Reformed Baptist movement in Ontario. Most of us here, I would guess, certainly many of us, belong to churches affiliated with the Sovereign Grace Fellowship of Canada, a group that consists of Sovereign Grace Baptist churches, otherwise known as Reformed Baptist churches or Calvinistic Baptist churches. The group has only existed formally for some 17 years, though its existence as a fellowship under the same name goes back to 1983. By any standards, we are a young fellowship. And it would be presumptuous to imagine that Reformed Baptist churches did not begin until we came on the scene. Before looking at our own generation, perhaps it would be appropriate to look briefly at the history of Calvinistic Baptist churches in Canada. Following the evangelical awakening of the 18th century, Calvinistic Baptist churches multiplied in the U.S. The Philadelphia Association was an influential group, and from these churches, evangelists were sent into Canada. It appears that the first Baptist churches to be formed in Canada were in Nova Scotia around 1763. One was in Sackville, the other in Yarmouth. The latter established the preaching of Ebenezer Moulton. Moulton was a missionary from Massachusetts. While he was essentially a Baptist, it seems that not all the members of the congregation were of that persuasion. There were some problems in the church, and it did not survive very long, nor did the Sackville church. In 1778, a new work was organized in Wolfville, Horton Baptist Church. This was distinctively Baptist. Moulton was again involved, but it appears he did not stick around very long, for his name does not appear among the founding members. This church was a vigorous work. Within the next 100 years, some 20 daughter works were started. There were hundreds of baptisms. The church had only 3 pastors in its first 100 years. One that was the longest was one for 60 years. His name was Harding. They called him Father Harding. Horton Baptist Church is the oldest continuing Baptist church in Nova Scotia and probably in Canada. The church was certainly Calvinistic in the beginning. In 1794, the first Baptist church in the province of Quebec was begun in Sawyerville, also by a missionary from the U.S. In the middle of winter, a hole was cut in the ice of a nearby lake and 15 people were baptized. The first Baptist church formed in Ontario was at Beamsville, just west of St. Catharines. Some put the date at 1776. However, the first Baptist church of Beamsville puts the date of their beginning at 1788. Perhaps there was a precursor. Another early church was founded near Kingston in 1796 by missionaries from the U.S. Church was organized in Charlotteville, just south of Simcoe, in 1803. The latter became the Victoria Baptist Church, which continues to this day. It was not until 1826 that the first Baptist Church was formed in Toronto. Interestingly, it was composed largely of fugitive slaves from the U.S. There was not only influence from the U.S., other men were sent from Scotland, from the church of the Haldane brothers, Robert and James, in Edinburgh. Some emigrated to Canada and were responsible for the establishing of Baptist churches in the Ottawa Valley. One of the men involved was Duncan MacPhail, who had been converted under the Haldanes. He was a schoolteacher, but also helped plant a church at Chatham, PQ. That church later became the Dalesville Baptist Church, and interestingly enough, the pastor there is Eddie Buchanan, who was a man holding to Reformed truth. When we were at Bowmanville, we used to support him when he was missionary in Japan. Church began around 1825. 10 years later, 2 men from Scotland, John Gilmore, William Fraser, joined the work and had the joy of seeing what became known as the Great Revival. Before the end of the year, 79 people were added to the church. Few details are available, but it seems that there were revivals in Dalesville, Breadalbane, and Montreal between 1834 and 36. MacPhail's son Daniel became an even more prominent figure. He'd been born in Scotland but came to Canada with the family. He was leader of the Sunday School in Dalesville from 1830 to 35. His teaching and preaching gifts were evident, and he went to Madison University in Hamilton, New York, to prepare for the ministry. He graduated in 1837 when he was 27. The following year, he started a church in Osgood, south of Ottawa. In 1840, he was ordained and pastored that church for 24 years. He was greatly used, not only at Osgood, but throughout the Ottawa Valley. 6 churches were planted in the area. MacPhail became known as the Elijah of the Ottawa Valley. Many were brought to Christ under his ministry, and he personally baptized over 1,000 converts. In 1865, he left the Osgood Church to become the pastor of one of the churches he had started in Ottawa, First Baptist. After 5 years, he left the pastorate for an itinerant ministry. Tragically, about a year later, in 1871, during a communion service, he suffered a stroke and was unable to preach again. He was not idle, however, became known as a great prayer warrior. 2 other men who had also descended from families converted under or influenced by the Haldanes and had outstanding ministries were D.A. MacGregor and R.A. Fife. MacGregor studied at Woodstock College, which seems to have been the main Baptist school at the time. He was at Woodstock from 1870 to 78. He pastored at Whitby in Brooklyn and then at Stratford before moving to Toronto Bible College, Toronto Baptist College in 1886. He eventually became principal there in 1889. It appears that Woodstock merged with Toronto Baptist College around that time. R.A. Fife became principal of Woodstock College from 1860 to 78 before moving to the Toronto College. Biographical material on MacGregor and Fife indicates that both were Calvinistic. growth of Baptist churches in Canada in the 19th century was steady. In 1848, the Regular Baptist Union of Canada was formed. They held a closed communion, and it can be reasonably assumed that most of the churches were Calvinistic. In 1888, the Baptist Convention of Ontario and Quebec was started. By 1900, there were 520 member churches, but it was not long before it was severely affected by liberalism. There were some voices who protested loudly against this tendency, the most vocal of which was T.T. Shields, the pastor of Jarvis Street Baptist Church. In 1926, as a result of these protests, Shields was censured by the convention and expelled. Many evangelicals then withdrew from the convention, and Shields was the leader in forming the Union of Regular Baptist Churches of Ontario and Quebec in 1927. While some within this group were Calvinistic, chief distinctive was a stand against liberalism. Shields was nominally Calvinistic, although one does not often find these truths declared in his sermons, which for many years were printed in the Gospel Witness. There were also printed books of some of his sermons produced. By 1930, there were 89 congregations in the Union, but a good many churches, while withdrawing from the convention, did not join the Union because of the militancy of T.T. Shields and his strong anti-Catholic stance. In 1948, there were divisions within the Union. These eventually led to the formation in 1953 of the Fellowship of Evangelical Baptist Churches in Canada, hereafter called the Fellowship. While all these churches were evangelical, and the statement of faith was mildly Calvinistic, in reality, pastors taking a consistent Calvinistic position were generally opposed by the leaders of the Fellowship. They were labeled as hyper-Calvinists. Some of those who did not join the Fellowship joined the Association of Regular Baptist Churches. Shields, of course, was the leader of that group, but the date I find for the actual beginning of the Association of Regular Baptist Churches was 57. Of course, that was 2 years after Shields' death, but certainly his influence was there. There was never more than about a dozen churches, with Jarvis Street being by far the largest. The main distinctive was anti-Catholicism and anti-ecumenism, although some of the pastors were reformed in their theology. Thankfully, within the Fellowship, there were some who did boldly proclaim the doctrines of grace. I've been trying to get information about the 50s, but have not been too successful. One significant figure was John Riesinger. John, of course, was an American, but was pastor at Long Branch Baptist Church, Fellowship Church in the west end of Toronto. He was there from 59 to 65. John was the means of several men coming to the doctrines of grace. Jim Clements was his assistant for a few years. It was great to see Jim and Kathy here this morning. Jim, in turn, influenced his brother Les. Ron Matthews was converted under John Riesinger's ministry in 1959 and later took the doctrines of grace to the mission field. Another pastor who came to see these truths in the 50s was Bruce Schnur. He was brought to a position through reading Lewis Sperry Chafee's Systematic Theology at London Bible Institute. He was also instrumental, at least partially, in influencing Jim Clements. In 1970, Bruce was forced to resign from his church because of his Calvinistic preaching. Bev Ward was another pastor who came to embrace Reformed theology in the 60s. He was influenced by reading papers from a Puritan conference. He later moved to BC. Then there was Ross Lyon, who pastored Kenmure Baptist for several years until 1970. He also preached these truths. He was followed in Kenmure by Gord Rumford. He was there from 70 to 75 and was one of the founding fathers of the FRPS. Gordon was also influenced by John Riesinger. John certainly had a significant influence in Canada, though not everyone was receptive of his ministry. After he left Long Branch, he went to a Fellowship Baptist Church in Woodstock and had to leave after about 2 years as his doctrine was rejected by some of the church leaders. He returned to the U.S., but continued to have a strong input into the Canadian scene through conferences. In particular, he spoke at the conference at Rockwood Acres. That was basically a camping conference on the property owned by Jim and Kathy Clements, north of Marmara. It was held for more than 30 years, and John was usually the main speaker. He spoke almost every year from 1971 to 2000. And a number of you here probably enjoyed the conferences at Rockwood Acres. We certainly did for many years. Our own men shared in the ministry. Meetings were held at a nearby Methodist chapel. John's influence was also increased by the Sword and Trowel, a magazine he first published in 1966, which continued for 20 years. It then became The Sound of Grace, which was actually in circulation until a couple of years ago. Another man who had a large influence in the 70s was Al Martin. Some of us heard him at conferences in the US. He was invited to a number of meetings and conferences here. He was always heard with great profit. Tapes of his sermons were widely circulated. Sadly, events we will mention later curtailed his influence in Canada. Another brother who held Calvinistic doctrines in the 60s was Bob Wilkins. He had been taught the doctrines of grace by Bob Strimple at Toronto Bible College, later OBC. Doubtless Strimple influenced others before moving to Westminster Theological Seminary. Bob Wilkins was to pastor churches both in the fellowship and the convention. Now, the man who was initially in the convention was Brian Robinson, also with us today. He was actually persuaded of the doctrines of grace by Clark Pinnock before Pinnock went to McMaster and went off the rails. Brian was preaching the doctrines of grace in the late 60s. There were other men who perhaps did not preach the doctrines of grace loudly, but were nevertheless supportive of those who did. One of these was Bob Brackstone. He was pastor at Chatham for many years. It was a great encouragement to people like Bruce Schnurr, the Clemens brothers, and also to Bill Payne. Another pastor in the same category as Bob Brackstone was Arnold Dallimore. He was pastor at Cotton Baptist from 1950 to 73. During his studies at Central Baptist Seminary, he became interested in George Whitefield, began to read everything he could find about this man. He wrote two biographies of Whitefield early in his ministry. However, publishers didn't seem interested, and eventually Dallimore himself put them aside. He began independent research and made several trips to the UK to find material. He was helped by such people as Ian Murray and Martin Lloyd-Jones. The first volume on Whitefield was published in 1970, the second in 79. It was during the many years of research and writing about Whitefield that Dallimore became convinced of the doctrines of grace. Like Brackstone, he was not known as a great proclaimer of these doctrines, but he believed them and supported those who preached them. He was the main speaker at one of the early Carey conferences, speaking on historical themes. Another significant person who predates all those mentioned is J.R. Boyd. He helped start Berean Baptist Church in Sudbury in 1936, after 3 years at TBS. I don't know if there was any development of his theology. I suspect not. He was undoubtedly a Calvinist when I first knew him in the 60s, but at times he seemed to delight in criticizing those who declared themselves in the Reformed camp. Perhaps he felt some of these men were too narrow. He had a remarkable ministry in Northern Ontario for about half a century and should not be overlooked in our history. Another brother who had an influence around this time was Bob Shaker. Some of you will remember Bob. Originally a member at Java Street Baptist Church. In fact, when we came to Canada in 63, we went to Java Street, I think about our third Sunday, and he greeted us, Mr. Shaker, and he was an usher at the door there greeting people coming in. He set up the Reformation Book Service in the north end of Toronto in the late 60s, I believe, and was instrumental in introducing many to good Reformed literature. During the late 60s and early 70s, there were a handful of men, already named, who were committed to the doctrines of grace and sought to preach them in their churches. The 60s were difficult days for Calvinistic pastors within the fellowship. Ironically, Reformed men within the convention had less opposition for the simple reason that there was no statement of faith by which to judge them. The convention embraced liberals and Calvinists alike. Loyalty to the convention was more important than a Reformed position. With quite a few pastors hurting at this time, there was need for occasions in which to encourage each other. Regular monthly meetings were started around 67. Initially, they alternated between Burlington and Milton. Bill Payne was pastor at Calvary Baptist Church in Milton, in Burlington at the time, and Clayton Coles was pastor of Emmanuel Baptist Church in Milton. Those who gathered would take turns in presenting papers, and often they would listen to a tape by such well-known men as Jim Packer, Eric Alexander, or Rolf Barnard. This was the beginning of what later became the Fellowship for Reformation and Pastoral Studies. The leader of the meetings was Bill Payne. And it is probably time to give some background information on Bill. Some of this material I gave at a pastor's conference in 2001 in a biography of Bill, but it won't hurt to repeat some of it, as some here may not know much about Bill Payne. Bill was born near Liverpool, UK of course, and as a result would be known as a Scouse in Britain. He never lost that distinctive Liverpudlian accent. Bill entered this world on April 16th, 1938, third son of Thomas Lamb Payne and his wife Hannah. There was some religious influence in the early years, as Hannah's father was a lay preacher. But apart from going to Sunday school at an Anglican church for a while, there was no real contact with the gospel. Bill's great love while at school was soccer. He dreamed of a professional career in that sport. Those at the early Carey or pastors' conferences will remember that if a game was organized, Bill would be there, still showing considerable ability. While Bill was in his teens, one of his friends, Malcolm Fenton, was converted. This had quite an impact on Bill. When his own mother started accompanying Malcolm's mother to church, Bill wondered what was going on. Eventually, his mother persuaded him to go with her, and for the first time in his life, he heard the gospel that he himself would later preach with such clarity. The church was Calvary Baptist Church, and the pastor was A.E. Chillington. Bill drank in the message and kept going back to hear the word of God. He also began to read and study the Bible for himself. After a few months, Bill came to a heart experience of the truths he heard preached by Pastor Chillington. He was nearly 17 when he was converted. From the beginning, Bill became active in the Lord's work at the church and attended every possible meeting, looking for ways to serve the Lord. It was not long before he was giving his testimony in meetings and demonstrating a gift for public speaking. When he was 18, he had his first speaking engagement outside his own church. He addressed a nurses' fellowship in Liverpool. Hetty tells us of the amusing conclusion. He did not know how to finish properly, so he simply said, "That's your lot," and sat down. Under the faithful ministry of A.E. Chillington, Bill grew in grace, developed his own gifts. Bill always had a great love and respect for the man who was his spiritual father. While at Calvary Church, Bill met Hetty Stevenson, who was later to become his wife. Hetty had attended Calvary for most of her life, was converted when she was 13. Both Bill and Hetty had a desire to serve the Lord in the full-time capacity, and together they developed a deep interest in work amongst Muslims in the Middle East. However, before they could take further steps in that direction, Hetty had to complete her nurse's training, and Bill had to do 2 years in the Army, National Service. The military is always a stiff test of the Christian's resolve to stand firm for the Lord, and Bill was equal to the challenge of the Lord's enabling grace. He was not ashamed to kneel down by his bed to pray in full view of a barrack room of unbelieving soldiers. Bill spent his military service in Essex, Spurgeon country, and found a pastor there who encouraged him in his walk with the Lord. The desire to go to the Middle East never wavered, and there were further opportunities to preach. Bill also began to study Greek with a view to entering Bible school. On returning to Liverpool, Bill took a job in a bank while waiting for Hetty to finish her training. They were married in August of 59. Together, they continued to seek the Lord regarding training for the mission field. While still in the army, Bill was considering Spurgeon's College, but Pastor Chillington advised against this because of the liberal tendencies of that school. About that time, Dr. Slade, pastor of Jarvis Street Baptist Church and president of Toronto Baptist Seminary, came to speak at Bill's church. At the close of the service, Dr. Slade said that he felt there was a young man there who was interested in training for Christian service and invited him to speak with him afterward. Hetty had not been able to attend that meeting, and Bill told her about his conversation with Dr. Slade. They were interested in Christian training, but not in Canada. However, the Lord had other ideas, and just 6 weeks later, they were on their way to Toronto Baptist Seminary. They arrived at the seminary eager to learn, but soon found they had some problems with the doctrines taught there. One was with eschatology. Pastor Chillington had been a premillennialist, a pre-tribulational dispensationalist. Bill and Hetty had never heard any other view. And the millennialism taught at the seminary seemed heretical. They even gave serious consideration to returning home. However, they were teachable. They were impressed by the godliness of those who taught them, especially Dr. Adams and Dr. Fletcher, and decided to stay and learn with an open mind. It was not long before they were convinced of the amillennial view. The other problem was Calvinism. This was also new to Bill and Hetty. Dr. Fletcher was a professor of systematic theology, a godly man, and a convinced Calvinist. Again, Bill and Hetty were patient and eventually came to accept the doctrines of grace as biblical. During Bill's first year at seminary, he was called to the pastorate of Central Baptist Church, a small congregation in Toronto. Bill preached twice every Sunday and also took the midweek prayer meeting. This was a valuable experience for him and added greatly to the training at the seminary. Amazingly, despite the heavy load, his academic standing never faltered, and Bill was top student each year. Throughout the 4 years of seminary, the vision for missionary work amongst Muslims never left Bill or Hetty. In their final year, they began to give serious thought to finding a missionary society with which they could work. A representative of the Bible Baptist Fellowship came to speak to the students at chapel one day. And after talking to the man, Bill and Hetty applied for a one-year course with a mission in Missouri. During this course, they came to realize that their newfound eschatological views would preclude them from going out with the Bible Baptist Fellowship. And while they never lost their interest in work amongst Muslims, they began to see the Lord leading them in a different direction, into the pastoral ministry. In July of 64, Bill was called to be pastor of Calvary Baptist Church in Burlington. During his 8 years there, the church grew steadily. The old building became too small. The church bought land just north of the Queen Elizabeth Way and erected a commodious new structure. Despite the growth and encouragement, the Lord took Bill and Hetty through some difficult times in their own experience. Their second son, John Charles, was born in October of 65. The baby had Down syndrome as well as serious heart problems. He lived for only 6 months, and the many trips back and forth to the hospital stretched the family to the limit. God doesn't make mistakes in the way he deals with his children, and while the episode brought many tears, it also taught Bill and Hetty many invaluable lessons and prepared them to minister with great compassion to those who went through trying times. During the years at Calvary, Bill began reading the Puritans. It was then that he gradually came to realize that being Reformed or Calvinistic was far more than holding the 5 points. The Puritans were men who applied the truths of God's sovereignty to every part of life, both personal and ecclesiastical. It would affect not only the truths preached, but the worship and evangelism of the church. My first contact with Bill, personally, was at a meeting of the students and alumni of TBS in March of 69. Bill gave a paper entitled, What Today's Preachers Can Learn from the Puritans. I actually wrote a report of it for the TBS magazine, The Seminarian. Bill was already very enthusiastic about the Puritans. Many church members are willing to subscribe to the doctrines of grace in theory, but when they are applied, there is often opposition. So it was at Calvary Baptist, as Bill sought to apply the Reformed faith to church worship, there were quite a few who set themselves against these reforms. The opposition increased until Bill was forced to resign from the church in the fall of 72, after 8 years. So ended the first main phase of Bill's pastoral ministry. As mentioned earlier, there was a general opposition within the fellowship to Calvinism. A number were expelled from their churches around the same time. I mentioned Bruce Schnur. Another brother who suffered the same fate was Lee Powell. also gave leadership in the early days of the Reform movement. Among the members of Calvary, many were indignant at the way in which their pastor had been treated. He wanted Bill to continue as their pastor. And although when he resigned, it was without any intention of splitting the church, Bill soon saw the need to begin a new work that would meet the spiritual needs of those who had either been converted under his ministry or who had their spiritual lives deepened through his preaching and counseling. In the fall of 72, a new church was begun in the home of John and Wilma Howie. The group agreed on the name of Trinity Baptist Church and asked Bill to be their pastor. Several different locations in Burlington were rented over the next 3 years before they were able to purchase the Zimmerman United Church on Appleby Line. They were able to complete renovations and move in and begin services in February of 76. So it was that a church that was thoroughly reformed and its convictions had its beginnings. By this time, several other men were seeking to bring their churches to a reformed position. Among them, besides several mentioned earlier, were Lee Powell and myself. Lee had been dismissed from Melrose Baptist Church, Fellowship Church, in the 70s, I believe, and in 74 founded Covenant Baptist Church in Toronto, a church that still continues, now pastored by his son Chris. Clayton Cole sought to bring the church in Milton to a reformed position, but experienced opposition. At the end of 1970, he moved to South Africa to be married. I was pastor at Berean Baptist Church in Toronto from 67 to 73. It was a regular Baptist church affiliated with Jarvis Street Baptist Church. It was about halfway through my ministry there that I came, as a result of my own studies in the Word, to believe and then to preach the doctrines of grace. By the end of my time there, the church was largely convinced of these doctrines, although one man, who was never a member, did leave because of them. Early in 73, shortly after the beginning of Trinity Baptist, I was called to Bowmanville Baptist, about an hour east of Toronto. There were never any major problems over Reformed theology. After a few years, I think I could say that it could be called a Reformed Baptist Church in terms of its doctrinal statement, its worship, and its ecclesiology. Returning to the pastor's fellowship begun in the late 60s. As mentioned, it alternated between Burlington and Milton. I began to attend the meetings in 1970, around the time I came to a full Reformed position. Some of the men from Western Ontario complained of the distance to attend these meetings, so we did for a while move the meetings to Tillsonburg, where Lambert Baptist was pastor. However, numbers did not increase, so we moved back to the GTA. Incidentally, Lambert Baptist was another man who, though he was not known as a strong Calvinist, nevertheless supported those who were. In 1972, it was felt there was a need to put the pastor's fellowship on a firmer footing. So it was that the Fellowship for Reformation and Pastoral Studies was born. We regretted the name afterwards, not that there was anything wrong with it, just its length. It was usually abbreviated to FRPS or more simply to FRIPS. I suppose July 31st, 1972 could be considered a significant date in the history of Reformed Baptist churches in Ontario. Four pastors, Bill Payne, Lee Powell, Gordon Rumford and myself, met to make plans for the future of the fellowship. Lee Powell was appointed chairman and I was the secretary treasurer. We planned meetings a year at a time, trying to balance the subjects between theological, biographical or historical, and pastoral or practical. As the name suggests, we wanted the meetings to be reformed in their theological emphasis, but pastoral in nature, so as to be helpful to those who were pastors. Most of the papers were given by our own men, but once or twice a year, we would invite someone outside our own group. Sometimes we could take advantage of notable speakers who happened to be in the area for other meetings. We determined, as far as possible, to have the papers in printed form. The speakers were asked to provide copies of the papers, usually at their own expense. We didn't have the funds to do otherwise. We also arranged for a subscription list so that those who couldn't attend the meetings could have the papers mailed out to them. Several copies were sent overseas, so we did have a slight international influence. I remember Earl Hulse saying he thought the papers were of a very high standard. The location of the meeting still moved around, but from 1975 on, the regular location became Royal York Baptist Church. It was a fellowship church in Toronto where John Bonham was pastor. Incidentally, it was John who kept bugging me until I started attending the early meetings. John was a number of those men who were supportive of those who preached the doctrines of grace without themselves being known within the fellowship as Calvinists. In 1978, Bill became chairman of the FRPS and from then on was the unquestioned leader of the group. Most who attended were Baptists, certainly the founding fathers were, but we were never a Baptist group as such. We deliberately avoided the term in the name of the organization. We're happy to welcome a number of Presbyterian pastors, as well as some from other denominations. For a number of years, we enjoyed the fellowship and contributions of Gerald Cressman, a Pentecostal pastor from Elmira, who later moved to a Bible college in Saskatoon. It was good having those of different ecclesiastical persuasions, and while there were differences of opinion, the differences rarely caused any animosity. I can only remember one or two occasions when there was any heat in the discussions, and I believe the rarity of such problems was due mainly to Bill's wise and gracious chairmanship. I think we were fairly open with those who were of different persuasions and sometimes invited them to present their views. John MacLeod, a staunch Presbyterian, was asked to speak on the nature of the church. I recall the lively debate when he maintained that heretics should still be put to death. Seriously. Gerald Cressman, the Pentecostal, was asked to speak on the gifts of the Spirit. That also created lively discussion. Poor Gerald was hard pressed, but it was all done in a gracious way. It is encouraging to see that the regular monthly pastors' meetings continue with some changes. Originally, we met morning and afternoon, bringing a packed lunch. The afternoons were usually more informal, and often, as mentioned earlier, would involve listening to a tape of a well-known preacher followed by a discussion. Sometimes the afternoons will be just discussion and prayer. The name of FRPS has disappeared, being replaced by Grace Pastors Fellowship. Some still call it Fritz. The location for many years now has been Thistletown Baptist Church. Now, a word on conferences. Bill had a vision for the reform movement in Canada and felt that we should do all we could to promote it. The monthly meetings were useful, but they were geared toward pastors, although anyone was free to attend. Bill suggested that we arrange meetings so that many more could attend. So from 1975 to 79, we held three-day conferences in Toronto. The 78 conference was cancelled at the last minute due to internal problems. That was the same time that Bill took over as chairman of the FRPS. The first of these conferences, Bill gave an unforgettable series on the intercession of Christ. While these conferences were well attended, we still felt the need to minister more to pastors in particular. So from 1980 on, we held annual pastors' conferences. First was held in Westboro Baptist Church in Ottawa, where Jim Clements was pastor at the time. After that, we met at Camp Shalom here near Cambridge. I think we were there for 17 years altogether before moving to Heritage College, then to the Faith Mission Center near Campbellville, and now back to Drost Lodge at Camp Shalom, which is ideal for small conferences. Whether you consider it a sad point or an advantage, the conferences were small, never attaining an attendance above 25 or 30, though others would come in for some of the meetings, especially in the evenings. Drost Lodge has four dormitories, as you know, each with about eight beds off a central room, which serves both for meetings and for meals, or it did in those days. The compactness of the facilities made for great fellowship, and we had many blessed times. We often wondered why so few attended. It certainly wasn't for lack of good preaching. Looking over the list of speakers is like a who's who of reform leaders. John Riesinger, Herbert Carson, Jack Graham, Al Martin, Tom Smith, Don Carson, Mariano de Ganji, Stuart Latimer, Jeff Thomas, Tom Wells, Stuart Olliott, Henry Crabendam, Palmer Robertson, John Armstrong. One would anticipate that a much larger group of pastors would want to hear such men. But it seems that many were unwilling to identify with the group was unashamedly Calvinistic in their beliefs. However, we had fine conferences year after year. in a small group, everyone soon gets to know everyone else. Another advantage of small numbers was found in the discussion times held after each day's session. That was again in the olden days. And in a special meeting usually held on the last afternoon. All could take part, and there was opportunity for all to submit questions for the speakers to answer. Because of the small number registering for these conferences, we were limited in being able to provide honoraria for the speakers. In fact, only the main speakers would receive any remuneration. In the case of those speakers coming from Europe, and several did, we could just about afford the airfare, but we needed them to come for 2 or 3 weeks so that we could have them speak at several of our churches, with each church contributing toward the speaker's expenses. The result of this for the conference was that the day sessions were usually taken by our own men. Experienced pastors like Bill Payne were always heard with profit, but the situation also gave opportunity for some of the younger pastors to develop their gifts. It is a bit daunting to speak to a group of pastors, however small. Pastors are a critical bunch. They expect much from those who address them. It is valuable experience then to put people in this situation. And hopefully the senior pastors among us were gracious in seeking to encourage these men. Certainly the older pastors were a great source of encouragement to those starting out in the ministry. Bill Payne in particular was a pastor's pastor, and many were the men, young and old, who were helped by his ministry and advice. One final bonus at these conferences was in the great meals. At the early conferences, the staff at Camp Shalom cooked the meals, but to cut costs and increase the quality of the food, some of the pastors' wives agreed to do the cooking. From then on, we were royally dined. Kathy and Pat Clements, I think, started that. Super spiritual men will say we gather primarily to feed the soul. But there is no doubt that excellent food and good humor add a great deal to a conference. These were both in abundance at the pastors' conferences. While we're now back at Dross Lodge, we have to settle for meals prepared by the staff here, which are quite satisfactory, if not as scrumptious as in the early days. Word about family conferences. Both the Payne and Fellows families had attended some of the early Reformed Baptist family conferences at Harvey Cedars in New Jersey. These events were organized by the Reformed Baptist Association, a group of 7 churches in the northeastern U.S. Al Martin and Walt Chantry were the 2 leading figures, and as they were insistent that everything be done under the auspices of a local church, Walt Chantry's church in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, actually sponsored the conferences. Al Martin was usually one of the main speakers in those days. We were exposed to some powerful preaching. About 500 to 600 attended, and they were rich times. At first, we Canucks almost felt lost in the crowd, but gradually we got known, and eventually both Bill and I were invited to speak at the conference. It was inevitable that sooner or later, one of us would say, "Wouldn't it be great to have something like this in Canada?" I can't remember who said it first, but it was probably Bill. And so we began to see what could be done. After looking at a number of sites, we decided on Camp Shalom. I've got out of chronological order by speaking about pastors' conferences first, but we actually held the first family conference a year before the first pastors' conference. Camp Shalom was chosen because of reasonable prices and also because of its good location. We had contacts in New York State and Michigan, as well as our Canadian contingent, so Cambridge seemed suitable. The first conference in 79, Walt Chantry spoke on the riches of God's glorious grace. It was Tulip in disguise. In the early days, we followed the pattern of the Harvey Cedars conferences by having 2 morning sessions. The first year, Bill repeated and enlarged his series on the intercession of Christ. The conference was a great success. We had about 50 the first year, and the numbers grew steadily to about 100 by the 5th year in 83. We always had a good U.S. contingent. This gave an international flavor. Fred Huebner was then a pastor in New York, New York State. He brought a group each year and contributed to the conferences by speaking on occasions and also by bringing an ever-increasing supply of books at bargain prices. We also had some great international sports contests. The Americans usually beat us at baseball, But at table tennis, Bill and I managed to remain undefeated in doubles competition. After the first 2 years, we felt that having two morning sessions was too taxing mentally, as most people feel they have to preach for an hour or more. So we reduced that to one morning session plus a discussion period. In 84, we moved to a new location, a Lambton Centre at Forest near Sarnia. Numbers dropped slightly the first year, but thereafter steadily increased to over 200, stretching to the limit the facilities at Lambton. In 94, the conference was moved again to Maple Grove at Thamesford near Ingersoll. Dale and I and our wives and a few others were involved in evaluating the new site and deciding to move. It was in that year that Pamela and I returned to Britain, so we were not involved in the conferences until we moved back to Ontario in 99. After the move, numbers grew to about 400. And in 2006, we moved to Braeside Pentecostal Camp near Paris, maintaining the numbers at around 400. Family conferences have been times of rich ministry and precious fellowship. Much of the credit, humanly speaking, belonged to Bill Payne. After we had arranged the program and contacted the speakers, Bill did most of the organizing of the family conferences. I looked after the pastors' conferences. Though Bill was ably assisted by people from his own church. In the early years, Don Wheaton was camp director. For many years, Mark and Marilyn Hudson carried a heavy load in handling registrations, arranging accommodation, and taking care of finances. In recent years, Harry Drugendyke has done an excellent job as camp director. Sovereign Grace Fellowship. As mentioned earlier, there were a number of churches that could be described as reformed, or at least had pastors who were seeking to move their churches in that direction. Whilst the pastors, and to some extent the churches, did enjoy fellowship on occasions, there was no formal association. Bill Payne in particular felt the need for a more formal fellowship of Reformed Baptist churches. So in 1983, the Sovereign Grace Fellowship came into being. It was a loose-knit organization that permitted membership of churches with ties to existing denominations, as long as they were not affiliated with the World Council of Churches. A few more joined later, but I don't believe the number ever exceeded 10. While different men held the position of chairman, Bill was the recognized leader of that group until his death. Since Bill's departure, we have sought to put the SGF on an even firmer footing. And in 2001, a constitution was adopted by 9 churches, a coordinator appointed, and the first convention was held that fall. Sovereign Grace Fellowship is still small, 15 churches at this point, I believe. And there are encouraging signs of growth, other churches showing some interest. And we trust that we, and especially the younger pastors, can build upon the foundation laid by Bill Payne and others. There are a few other areas I'd like to touch on. First is missions. There have always been those who would accuse Calvinists of not being concerned for evangelism and missions. There may be a minority of whom this is true, but church history should silence those who make such accusations. Names such as George Whitfield, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, William Carey make it very clear that holding Reformed theology does not hinder evangelism, whether at home or on the mission field. Among our own men, there have been several who have made significant contributions on the mission field. Ron Matthews, I mentioned, was converted under John Riesinger's ministry, was for many years a missionary in Colombia with a fellowship. He did experience some opposition from the fellowship hierarchy. Though I remember Charles Long, who was quite influential in fellowship circles, saying that when he visited the churches started by fellowship missionaries in Colombia, the one founded by the Matthews was the most solid among them. Don Whiteside, who was unashamedly Calvinistic, also served with a fellowship in Colombia. He was instrumental in setting up many of the national pastors in beekeeping. He also set us up in beekeeping. And that was a very helpful thing for men in financially poor churches. They could get a reasonable income with relatively few hours. Hugh Gordon came to Canada in 1963. He had been converted and raised under a sound Calvinistic ministry in Northern Ireland. In 1967, he went as a missionary to Pakistan with what was then the Ceylon and India General Mission. Later that became part of the International Christian Fellowship and eventually was absorbed by the SIM. Hugh worked in Pakistan for many years. One of his colleagues was Eric Wright, who was also to some degree influenced by Hugh in coming to a reformed position. Controversy. The recent reform movement in North America has had a somewhat checkered history. In the early 70s, when some of us began to have contact with the reform men in the US, it took a while to assess things simply because of the size of the country and the numerous groups. There were sovereign grace groups in certain parts who held their own distinctive views. For example, there were groups that were Calvinistic and at the same time dispensational. A group in Ohio like that. Some in the South had their own distinctive leadership, did not seem to seek the fellowship of others. One man who did move among the different groups and to some extent helped to unite them was John Riesinger. Al Martin did that to a lesser extent. While there were differences between the groups, there did not seem to be any hostility. But sadly, that changed in 1979. While the controversy was largely confined to the US, it did have wider implications, and that's why I'm touching on it. A key figure in the controversy was John Zenz. He studied at Bob Jones University and at Covenant College in Georgia before finally graduating from Westminster Seminary in 72. He was one of the first to promote New Covenant theology. His views were mainly circulated in articles published in the Baptist Reformation Review, a magazine of which he later became the editor. His views were vigorously opposed by Al Martin, Walt Chantry, and others. He was accused, unfairly I believe, of antinomianism, though some of his views were perhaps a little extreme and odd. Later he got involved with the house church movement. Many of his views on New Covenant theology were taken up by John Riesinger. The Harvey Cedars Conference, family conference in 79, Walt Chantry spoke against two areas of theology that gave him great concern, New Covenant theology and theonomy, otherwise known as Reconstructionism. In case some are unacquainted with theonomy, involves the view espoused by such people as R.J. Russ Dooney, Greg Barnson, that we should seek to apply God's law not only in the church but in our nations. Unless God's law is specifically abrogated in the New Testament, then it should be applied today. Our nations should become theocracies, and certainly our churches should be committed to the law of God. The two positions, of course, New Covenant theology and theonomy, are poles apart. Being at the conference, I personally felt that Chantry did not do a very good job in refuting either. The substance of his messages was later published by Banner of Truth in his book, God's Righteous Kingdom. Sadly, this was the beginning of a deep rift between different groups in the Reform community. Few would differ from Chantry in his opposition to theonomy, but Chantry, Martin, and many others took a strong stand against New Covenant theology. The opposition spilled over into Canada. In the US, there were several attempts to get both parties together to discuss things in a gracious and biblical way, but those espousing covenant theology refused to attend. In February of 1980, Al Martin addressed the FRPS, Monthly Pastors Group, on the topic Law and Gospel. He strongly condemned New Covenant theology as antinomian. Many of our men were quite disturbed by his harsh approach. Most of the SGF pastors would espouse New Covenant theology, but what is encouraging is that the division over the issue has rarely created hard feelings. At least that is my perception. I know there are pastors we know and love and who sometimes associate with us who hold a different position, but it does not cause serious division, and it is my conviction that this should not be a primary issue or a test of fellowship. I regularly preach in OPC churches that hold a covenant theology in its Sabbatarianism, but it does not affect our love and fellowship. Another division that arose just a couple of years after the so-called law-grace controversy was the issue of authoritarianism. Some felt that pastors were to rule, and that seemed to be to overshadow all else. Sadly, that matter separated Al Martin and Walt Chantry, and of course people aligned themselves with one side or the other. This matter has also spilled over into Canada. We have seen a few churches split over the issue. Again, I'm thankful that it has not had far-reaching repercussions. Now, the matter that has caused some differences is the use of modern hymns and musical instruments. Some churches prefer to remain very conservative and traditional in their hymns and music. Others feel that to encourage younger people to attend our churches, we should be a little more contemporary. It is my conviction that this also should not be a test of fellowship. While we may prefer a certain style of worship, I think we should not divide over the issue. And it is largely a generational matter. Publications. Bill Payne felt the need of a magazine that would express our position and that was distinctively Canadian. And in October of 78, the first issue of Reformation Canada appeared. It basically followed the format of Reformation Today, begun and edited for many years by Errol Hulse. Bill was the editor of Reformation Canada, and I helped him as managing editor almost from the beginning. It was published four times a year until the final issue in 1994. That was when Bill had major heart surgery and I returned to the UK. Subscriptions never rose beyond 250, but we produced 700 copies each time, most of which were sent free of charge to various churches and individuals. Later, the Sovereign Grace Journal was produced. Brian Robinson initiated this in 1998, and it continued for 11 years until it was replaced by the Barnabas magazine. I helped Brian with this endeavor after returning from the UK in 1999. In addition, a number of books and pamphlets have been produced by Bill Payne and others. None of our publications has quite matched John Piper's books in circulation, but hopefully they have had and continue to have some influence for good in terms of sound doctrine. Theological education. I previously made reference to some of the Baptist colleges in the 19th century. I've tried to trace the development of these schools. We really need to begin in Montreal. In 1838, a Scottish pastor named John Gilmore established Canada Baptist College in Montreal. For some reason, it closed after just 11 years. One of the principals was R.A. Fife. In 1857, Fife and others founded the Canadian Literary Institute in Woodstock, Ontario. It was later renamed Woodstock College. Fife was the principal from 1860 to 78. Senator William McMaster urged that something similar be established in Toronto. And then it appears that the Woodstock College moved there in 1883 with financial help from McMaster. It was named Toronto Baptist College. D.A. McGregor joined the faculty in 1886 and became principal in 1889. R.A. Fife also relocated there. It became a Christian university and moved to Hamilton in 1928. The name was changed to McMaster University in view of a large bequest made by McMaster at his death in 1888. I noted earlier that it was very likely that in view of the connection with the Haldane brothers, the theological emphasis of these schools would initially be Calvinistic. We know the drift that took place in McMaster. They claim they have reversed the trend toward liberalism, but we also know the drift towards open theism and other errors. Certainly they would not be distinctively Calvinistic. When T.T. Shields began the Union of Regular Baptist Churches in 1927, he also started Toronto Baptist Seminary. It was certainly evangelical, but like the Union, the emphasis seemed to be more on the negative than the positive. My own contact with TBS began in 1963. T.T. Shields had been dead for 8 years then, and whilst the overall teaching in the seminary was Calvinistic, some of the professors were not. Some of the speakers brought in for special events like commencement or graduation were anything but Calvinistic. Things changed with the arrival of Eric Gurr at Jarvis Street in 1975. Despite significant problems under his ministry in the church, the theology taught at TBS has been soundly reformed since those days. TBS is not the only theological institution in Ontario where Reformed theology is taught, but usually in other schools there is quite a mix. Just as a group of pastors separated from T.T. Shields to form the Fellowship in 53, So too, there was a split from TBS. In 1949, W. Gordon Brown led a group to separate from TBS and form the Canadian Baptist Seminary, later to be called Central Baptist Seminary. Most of the early professors would have been Calvinists, but there was a mixture, and just as there was opposition within the fellowship to men who were Reformed, so there was the same opposition within Central. I suppose they would have called themselves mild Calvinists or four-point Calvinists. Any who were five-pointers were labeled hyper-Calvinists. In 1993, Central merged with London Baptist Seminary to form Heritage Baptist College and Seminary. The Baptist was later replaced by Bible. For a while, there was a drift not only away from Calvinism, but even from an orthodox theological position, such areas of women's ministry. However, there does seem to have been a moving back to a sound position, and even to more of a Calvinistic emphasis. This is probably due to such men as Stan Fowler, though a number of others will be Calvinistic too. Now, in conclusion, let me draw a couple of lessons from what we've seen. Looking back, it's legitimate to ask why the growth of the Sovereign Grace movement in Ontario, as well as other provinces, has been so slow, numbers so small. Why can we only draw a handful to our meetings? The family conferences obviously have been an exception. Quality of ministry is not the reason, as we've already noted. We've had a high standard of ministry at all our conferences. One reason has been the reluctance of people, particularly pastors, to be identified with the movement for fear of being labeled hyper-Calvinist. This was due in part to the hostility shown by the fellowship hierarchy to reform men within the fellowship. My own church at Bowmanville was in the fellowship, so I was well aware of that hostility. Since returning to Canada in 1999, I've not had very much opportunity to sense the climate in the fellowship. But from what I've seen, there is not as much hostility these days. And I can suggest three reasons for this. First, those who were originally so hostile are no longer around. Second, more Calvinists are coming out of the seminaries, not only in Ontario, but elsewhere in Canada and the US. And that is certainly cause for thanksgiving. But there is another reason. Often when people come to embrace the doctrines of grace, it brings a radical change in their ministry. I've heard it described as a second conversion. Pastors who change their theological position wonder why they haven't seen these things before. They also wonder how anyone else can fail to see them. Consequently, there was in the early days of the movement a tendency to beat the drum of Calvinism in an unbalanced and sometimes a belligerent way. I heard of one situation when a pastor's Calvinistic preaching had caused deep division in his church. A mediator was brought in, and during the discussion, he asked the pastor how long it took him to see the doctrines of grace. He replied, "So many years, I forget the exact number." One of the deacons in the church then spoke up, "It took you that long that you expect us to see these things in a few months." I think this aggressive teaching of the doctrines of grace and that imbalance in the preaching of some was a cause of hostility against the position. It is important not only to preach the doctrines of grace, but also to exhibit the grace of the doctrines. Bill Payne was balanced and gracious in his preaching, but because of the harshness of a few, he was a recipient of some of the hostility generated against the movement. If all the men had followed Bill in his balanced approach to Calvinism, there might well have been less hostility, though it will never be entirely absent in this life. Bill did experience opposition in his attempts to apply Calvinism in every area of church life. Some might argue that he tried to do it too quickly, but who is to say? Another accusation against the Reformed pastors was the neglect of evangelism. Perhaps there was again some justification for that charge. Sometimes when men come to see the glorious truths of God's sovereign grace, they are so taken up with them, they do not preach with as much evangelistic fervor as they should. Some also find it difficult to reconcile God's electing grace with a free offer of the gospel. Of course, one reason why some were accused of having no love for the lost was because they didn't give altar calls. I recall giving a well-known pastor some Reformed pamphlets, one of which was by Al Martin. I suggested to the pastor that Al would be a good speaker to invite in for special meetings. He asked a single question, does he give altar calls? When I said he did not, he replied, then we don't want him around here. He then launched into a tirade against those who had no love for the lost. My defense of the evangelistic nature of Al's preaching was lost in a torrent of abuse. Bill Payne, of course, did not give altar calls, and he wrote a pamphlet entitled, Why I Do Not Use the Invitation System. But his sermons were often evangelistic, contained fervent invitations to come to Christ. He certainly believed in the free offer of the gospel and made that very clear in his preaching. That is another area in which we need to emulate our departed brother. As we all know, in theory, Reformed truth and evangelistic fervor are not opposed. As mentioned before, church history shows an abundance of great preachers and missionaries who were both committed Calvinists and zealous evangelists. We need to follow their example by demonstrating both sides in our preaching. Coming back to John Riesinger, he was another man who exemplified evangelistic zeal combined with sound Reformed theology and set us a great example of that balance. In recent years, I have seen much more mellowness among Reformed pastors. We need to be gracious and warm in our preaching of Reformed truth. We also need to be wise in the way in which we introduce Reformed theology in situations where it has not already been widely embraced. I remember speaking with a young pastor who was about to start a new pastorate in a church that was not entirely committed to Calvinism, though it had had a faithful biblical ministry for many years. He was planning to begin his ministry with a series on the 5 points, and I urged him not to at that point. He ignored the warning, and in little more than a year, the church had not only split, it had ceased to exist. It is far better to introduce the doctrines of grace gradually during regular exposition than to preach them topically at an early stage in one's ministry. I believe that the Reformed pastors who are around today are more fervent in their evangelistic preaching than some pastors in the 60s and 70s. Brothers, we do need to follow the example of people like John Riesinger and Bill Payne. I trust with a more gracious and balanced preaching of these truths and a compassionate and zealous preaching of the gospel to the lost, the movement will grow, that is glorious. The glorious doctrines of sovereign grace will commend themselves to many and build strong churches with a fervent evangelistic spirit. Amen.